Welcome into this week's edition of AWE Unleashed. I am Chris Tubbs. This episode is all about the one and only, the legendary Nick Bockwinkel. He was a close friend of George and especially Mick. And before we get into it, I want to thank you guys for all of the tremendous feedback that we've gotten. I've heard nothing but good things. And let's bring in Mick and George as well. And guys, I don't know what you guys have been hearing about the feedback that we've done so far, but it has been overwhelmingly just to the moon and back.
We have been excited, believe me. Nothing but positive, and even from some of the workers in the business that are sharing thoughts that this is long overdue. So thank you, everyone. We appreciate it. This is great.
Like Roger Kent used to say, or Rod Trongard, you know, we're in other lands now. We're in other countries, and just tremendous feedback. Everybody is so positive about it. They're loving hearing the stories about the old AWA. It's about time, and we are just getting started. We're right out of the blocks. Bigger and better things ahead.
Yeah, last week was just kind of a rapid fire around the horn where we're going to kind of tell you about some of the topics that people have suggested. First one was all about Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo, and you can tell on the bottom of the screen. Today's all about Nick Bockwinkel. Before we get into it, I do want to say that you can find us on all your podcast platforms, whether it's Spotify or Apple, iTunes, YouTube, whatever. If you're on YouTube, I know a lot of people love it. We've got some exclusive features and pictures that you guys are going to be able to see just by looking at that. So again, check us out on all your podcast platforms. Rate, review, subscribe, comment, because those things really help us grow this thing. And again, this is all about you guys. This is all about what you guys want to know and want to hear. And today, it's all about the legendary Nick Bockwinkel. Of course, we're talking about the AWA, but George, I want to ask you that when it comes to Nick Bockwinkel, yeah, he, you know, we're talking about the AWA, but he had a pretty successful run before this. And I believe he was coming from the Georgia territory, if I'm not mistaken.
He was. And Nick did what most wrestlers of that era did. He worked in the business for about 15 years before he made it to the main events. And that was normal. Guys had to work around the territories and learn their trade. He got into the business in 54 with his daddy teaming a little bit out in California. Warren Bockwinkel had been a wrestler for the 15 or 20 years before that. Nick was trained by three guys, his dad, Warren, Lou Thez, and Wilbur Snyder, who was about 10 years older than Nick. Together, I don't think you come up with three better trainers. Nick worked a lot of territories. He also worked, this is interesting, because when he went into the Army, they didn't want the wrestlers or guys wrestling. So Nick would go and wrestle off base, and he would be Nick Warren, or Dick Warren, or Nicky Warren. And his superiors were none the wiser. One of them did say, "You look like this guy that wrestled," and Nick just brushed it off. But he worked all the territories like most wrestlers did of that era. He was in the Pacific Northwest Territory, where he did gain some championships and worked with some of his future opponents. He was in California. He was in Hawaii. He was in Florida. He was in Texas. And then he landed in Georgia in 1969. And this was where the Nick Bockwinkel that we started to see in the AWA took place.
So what were you guys' first impressions of him when he was coming into the territory?
I was blown away. You know, I back then it's all wrestling magazines and no internet and what have you. And I had heard of Nick Bockwinkel, you know, and read some of his escapades and knew that he had a pretty decent career going. George had kind of covered that a little bit. By the way, Nick debuted here in April of 1956, so long before
Mario de Souza.
Oh, good Lord. I think you're the only person in the world, George, that would remember that. Yep, Mario de Souza. But I was just blown away. Nick was totally different. You know, your typical wrestling heel would spew this and that and insults about his opponents and grab the announcer by the throat and, you know, spittle coming down his mouth and everything else. But Nick wasn't like that. Nick was quiet. He was conceited, arrogant, whatever you want to say. He had the million-dollar vocabulary, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But he was completely different. And right from the outset, I thought, you know what? This guy is really going to be something here in this territory.
When Nick debuted on TV, All-Star Wrestling, on December 10th of 1970, it was typical in those days for a wrestler that won a match on television that they would get a very brief interview with Marty O'Neill. So Nick wins. He's a newcomer. Nobody's seen him before. Marty asked him very briefly, Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself. And Nick folded his arms and he said that he had been wrestling for 15 years, that his dad was in the business. I'm a second generation wrestler. He said, but I have been trying for the past 10 years to get a championship match. And he says, the champion, Vern Gagne, has ran from every territory I was in. He's eluded me. And he said, I am now in Vern Gagne's backyard. And he won't elude me anymore. And he looks at the camera and he says, in Hawaii, where I was champion, when someone is leaving, we say aloha. Directly at the camera, he says, aloha, Vern Gagne. And he walked off. I was immediately on this guy's bandwagon because he never raised his voice. He was calm and collected, unlike any other heel we had ever seen. He just said it matter of fact, aloha, Vern Gagne.
So he is known for all of these, you know, big words and having a dictionary and just being able to alliterate and be so much different than everybody else. But was there a point, George, where he might have needed a little bit of help with a word or two?
Well, you know, when Nick was on his interviews, honest to God, everybody was sitting there listening because he threw out what you'd call $10 words. The average wrestling fan sitting at home with a bag of popcorn and their second beer, watching their black and white rabbit ear TV, they had no idea what any of this was. Okay? And so Nick, he was at one of Nick's Bockwinkel Brigade, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But he was at his brigade convention, and I had put together, which at that time was as close as I could come to a one-loss record of Nick's matches from the beginning of his career. And I had given Nick a copy, to which he looked up at me at first and said, you're sick. But, and you had to know him to appreciate that. But I said to him, Nick, I also have a copy for myself that I'm going to keep, and I'd love it if you would autograph it for me. So Nick grabbed my Sharpie. He starts to write on it. He says, to George, my favorite. And he looks up at me from his chair and he says, how do you spell statistician? I said, how the hell do I know? You're the guy with the Funkin' Wagnalls. I have no idea.
Oh, look at that, George.
1974 in front of Care 11. Wow. He told me on that picture, he says, who knows more about me than me? I think that says it all.
I want to add to the Bockwinkel vocabulary. First of all, it is a fact. Nick had a little dictionary that he carried with him. And before he went out and cut those promos on TV, he would look for a word that he'd never heard of before. And he'd come out and use it on television. So it wasn't exactly spontaneous. The other thing, to kind of piggyback on what George said about asking to spell a word, one time I asked Nick if he would write a little note for the Bockwinkel Fat Club Bulletin, you know, and I would print it. And he wanted to spell the word whoopee. That was it. And the whole gist of this was he was going to talk about, oh, whoopee, I get to write for the bulletin or whatever. And the man asked me how to spell whoopee. And I said, I don't know, Nick, there's probably variations of it. Well, he spelled whoopee, I think it had four P's in it. There may have been a Q, maybe a Z. It looked like Mississippi backwards. But you had to know Nick Bockwinkel. And the thing of it is, he was a really intelligent guy. I mean, worldly to a fault, but as far as the vocabulary is concerned, I'm telling you, you know, are you smarter than a fifth grader? So it was enjoyable.
Well, and I have that bulletin that has the word, I think it's supposed to be statistician, but again, it looks like something that is backwards and not correct. It's a collector's item.
Speaking of words, he was paired with Bobby Heenan, and the way that it sounds, guys, he didn't need it, but I mean, we hear the word humanoid from Bobby Heenan. He made that famous, you know, later on. That's how a lot of people, you know, they kind of make that connection, but he was using words like that. And the pairing with Heenan, I want to ask you guys, why did it work, even though it didn't seem like it was necessary? And I mean, what did they think about the pairing? Were they both happy with it? Did they not want to do it? I mean, kind of, you know, take me through that.
In the scheme of things, it was brilliant. And I don't know if it was Vern that came up with the idea or Wally, but Nick had been here for about 3.5-4 years by the time they paired the two together. And why did it work? Because you had the two absolute best at their individual craft. The best wrestler in the world, the best manager in the world. And in theory, you would think, you know, Nick's a great talker. What does he need Bobby Heenan for? Bobby Heenan's a great talker. What is it? But it was absolutely magical. And Heenan being the loudmouth during the interviews and Nick just looking into the camera with the 8-to-5 humanoid lifers, it was a marriage made in heaven. And to me, the best manager-wrestler combination ever in wrestling.
Bar none, the best. And the thing that worked for him was the fact that Bobby Heenan was really the direct opposite of what Nick was on an interview, because yep. Bobby would get upset. Bobby would get excited. He would start getting irritated on the camera, and he did it so well. And Nick would always just be composed. But the interesting thing about their relationship is that, as Mick pointed out, Nick was a wrestler. There isn't a fan out there that didn't realize that Nick Bockwinkel could wrestle as well as Wilbur Snyder and Vern Gagne and all the other classic babyface wrestlers. But he had this little weasel in his corner that would interfere or cause the referee to be distracted, and that allowed Nick to cheat. And he didn't need to cheat. And that's what was the genius about it. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it successful. So when he would come on camera and refer to him as Sir Robert of Heenan, you know, how classic is that? And he would talk down to the fans. Again, those guys sitting on their couch with their beer and chips watching, they're the average guy, and he calls them 8-to-sock White Sock lifers. How can you insult anybody any worse? And so they wanted to see him get his butt kicked. It was a marriage that was perfect. And it was genius. Absolutely.
So, you know, you're kind of talking about the fans and the interaction with the fans and whatnot. I know that, Mick, you ran his fan club. I mean, how did you become a fan? You know, you said kind of that first night you were hooked, but what got you so involved in him to the point that you started a fan club for Nick Bockwinkel?
I had actually run some fan clubs earlier. Several years earlier, as a teenager, I put up some fan newsletters, and the bug kind of bit me to do it again. And what's interesting about it is that when that bug did bite, the first guy that I approached was Bobby Heenan. Believe it or not, I approached the Brain before I talked to Nick Bockwinkel. Not that Nick was second choice, but I happened to be at the Dyckman Hotel, downtown Minneapolis, where the wrestling office is, or was. And Bobby came in to get his paycheck or whatever, and he's in the lobby. And I said, Mr. Heenan, I admire your work so much. I'd love to start a fan club for you. And Bobby said, and I quote, get the hell away from me, punk. So when that failed, Nick was going to be the second guy that I would approach. And for some reason, I had real trepidation about approaching Nick. His persona... I didn't know him well, so is this the real Nick Bockwinkel that I'm going to get here? And he's going to tell me to get lost. Two rejections in a month is not good. But
kind of like your love life.
Well, that's more than two. But I met Nick at the Calhoun Beach Hotel where they're doing the AWA TV tapings. And this is June 12th, 1971. And the week prior to that, Nick had wrestled at the Minneapolis Auditorium, and there was a group of us that held up a banner that said, Nick is number one, Nick's our guy, whatever it was. This is long before the days of where they wanted you to carry a sign. So an usher, because some wrestling fans had complained about it, came up and tore the sign out of our hands. Well, this was my inroad to talking to Nick at the TV studio as he was leaving the TV. As he was leaving the TV tapings. And I said, you know, Nick, this is what happened. They pull the banner right out of our hands and blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, Nick in his usual Nick Bockwinkle fashion. You know, that's too bad or what have you. So he started talking about running a fan club for him. And there was a couple of guys there that back in those days, you had to have the honorary sign a permission slip in order for you to run, at least promote the fan club. And
it's like a parent permission slip that you couldn't run it without having this? I mean, how could you verify it? Like, how could you make sure that it wasn't just some forged document?
Well, in those days, and this was strictly to get publicity in the wrestling magazines. I mean, you had to provide a permission slip in order to be talked about in one of the fan club columns. And George knows this because he was a fan club columnist. But so Nick is signing this permission slip after he gave me the ground rules about running his fan club. Don't contact me. I'm not going to give you a dime. If you need help with your this, that, and the other thing, forget about it. You know, if you want to do it, God bless you, my boy. Go ahead and do it. One of the guys on the permission slip was actually Paul Pershman, who eventually became Playboy Buddy Rose. So he is one of the guys along with me that was on the permission slip. And we went from there. And the guy who would never, ever contribute a dime or a minute to the fan club was so gracious. For the next two decades, he'd write letters for the newsletter. He would meet us at fan club conventions. Everything he said he wouldn't do. He loved it. He would never admit that he loved it, but he did.
You know, after I listened to you now for the last 2 minutes on that and getting that permission slip and the way you said that you went to Bobby Heenan first, I am only sorry that I hadn't known this story earlier. If I could have gotten rid of you simply by saying, get the hell away from me, punk. The last 50 years, I wouldn't have had to endure Mick Karch. Oh, man. Great story, though. I love it.
So when he came into the AWA, guys, George, what did he know about his position in the AWA? I mean, did he kind of know what the hierarchy was when he was coming in?
When Nick was contacted by Wally Carbo, obviously through Vern Gagne, to come into the AWA, Vern and Nick had talked about Vern transitioning the title to him at some point in time. And originally, it was going to be as soon as the summer of 1971. So Nick would have been here about 6 or 7 months at that point in time, because he debuted in December of 70. And history changed that when the Hercules Cortez was killed in a car accident the day of the All-Star Wrestling card on July 24th, 1971. And Vern changed course a little bit. Ray Stevens had come in. He hooked him up with Nick, and a dynamic combination. Nick and Ray just took off, and it got delayed for a while. But Nick was promised the title, and he was going to be champion.
You know, in true Vern Gagne fashion, I guess everybody said Vern was just a little bit behind the times towards the end of the AWA run. When George says it was delayed a little bit, yeah, it was delayed for about 4+ years. But nonetheless, Nick was the villainous heel chasing the champion, and history will bear out that it turned out just fine. And I was there the night that he won the title from Vern, November 8th, 1975. And I was so accustomed to Stanley Blackburn, you know, in sitting in his smoking jacket in Amarillo, Texas, sending in a videotape. You know, I've watched the tape and we're reversing this decision because it was a little bit of a controversial ending when Nick won the title. But all of a sudden, they're talking on TV that this thing stuck. And I was absolutely thrilled as a Bockwinkel fan. And Vern trusted Nick Bockwinkel to carry the ball. Vern did not trust a lot of people, but by that time they had established this 4 or 5 year relationship. And Vern knew if he passed the baton to Nick, everything was going to be just fine.
Well, why do you think? One of the things that Nick wanted, or Vern wanted to do when Nick came in, was Vern wanted to slow down a little bit as far as his own wrestling activities. And so that's why Nick was originally going to get the title. And the deal turned out when Nick and Ray became so good together, Vern was able to draw with a lot of tag team main events, and Nick and Ray together were magic. So Vern was able to halt his schedule without really giving up the title. You know, if you look at results, it was infrequent defenses. But by the time we got to 75, Vern was ready to take a back seat, and that's when he put it on Nick. And like we say, the rest is history. I mean, you couldn't have come up with a better heel champion.
So how was their relationship over the years between the two of them? I mean, did it have its ups and downs? And I mean, was it always a really good working relationship between the two of them, meaning Vern Gagne and Nick Bockwinkel?
I would like to say this. Nick and Vern, as Mick said, were good friends. And Vern trusted Nick. That says a lot, because that's going to be your heir apparent. But Greg Gagne told me a story once. Or actually, Nick told me the story about Greg Gagne. Nick said that Greg and Vern had approached him and said that you are going to be our champion. This is your home. Buy a house. Reside here. This is your home. And Nick said, I looked at Vern and I said, everything you say is fine, but I'm smart enough to realize that this is your home. And at any given notice, I could be somewhere else. So he said, I'm all on the board here, but I'll never lose the fact that you're the boss. And I think that's where their relationship came from. Nick knew his place, and he believed that if something happened, he could be gone from the territory, or he may get an offer to move on.
You know, Chris, you hear about all the guys that had heat with Vern and then left the territory. Whether it's Jesse Ventura or, you know, even guys that didn't leave, the late Stan Kowalski, Larry Hennig, they always tended to put the bad mouth on Vern a little bit. I never, ever heard Nick say a bad word about Vern Gagne. George said that Nick knew his place. He did. And Nick was smart enough to realize he's on top. He's making a lot of money. He's got a nice house here. Nick was a man of integrity and a professional, and they just got along. I don't know if they were best buddies by any means, you know, socializing together, but from a business standpoint, they got along just fine.
And Nick said the same thing about Vern as he told me about Billy Robinson a couple of times. He said, in order to get along with Vern, you let Vern do what Vern wants to do. And that's the way it worked. As long as they had that understanding, Nick was he was a player. He knew that if he got a better offer or that something changed, you know, we're talking a multiple territory day in the 70s where any wrestler could go anywhere on a given notice and make maybe more money. So Nick was open to that. He always understood his place. And he said, I just let Vern run his company and I played along.
So you're talking about friendships and kind of how, you know, people worked well with Nick. Mick, I know that, you know, you were running the fan club and everything, and over the years that you developed a pretty good friendship with him. Why did that relationship work? I know that you said you were really careful to not want to cross the line and kayfabe with him. Do you feel like that was one of the reasons why your friendship became genuine and you did get so close to him?
I think so. I think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, certainly I drove the guy crazy, you know, in a lot of ways when I would ask for fan club assistance and what have you. But yeah, I think the real key was that Nick knew what I knew, but I never broached the subject with him. I mean, it was his business. I didn't need to ask him about finishes or angles or who's coming into the territory or anything else. I respected him. I would ask him a favor, and if he was too busy at the time, he'd say, I'll get back to you. I'll do it in a month from now. He always did. I think it was just a mutual respect thing. And back in those days, and George will attest to this, you had to earn the trust of the guys in the business. You could not, like it is today, anybody walks into a locker room and starts glad-handing everybody. Not back then. You walked into a locker room then and you were an outsider. You were kayfabed and that was it. So the mutual trust thing, I think, was the biggest thing. And then longevity. You know, the more years that went by, the more, the closer Nick and I got, and he became, you know, close to my family and my kids and my wife and what have you. So, yeah, it was a really enduring relationship.
Well, was there ever a time that he got upset with you over anything?
One time, and, I mentioned the Billy Robinson story last time, but the one time Nick was visibly livid with me. And I'll make a long story short. I was doing the equivalent of backyard wrestling back in the day, way, way before it was fashionable to set up a ring, you know, and mats in your backyard. And I had done it at a junior high school in Northeast Minneapolis, actually promoted the thing. And while this event is going on, Nick was over in Japan. Well, Paul Pershman, Buddy Rose, a friend at the time, attended the card, and for some reason, other than the fact that, you know, I don't know if he was trying to stir the pot or what, he told Nick on an airplane going from Minneapolis to Denver or whatever it was, hey, did you see what Mick was involved in? Well, comes a night at the St. Paul Civic Center, and Nick had gotten word of this in our show, and he came up to me, and he said, come here, I want to talk to you. Oh, God. He said, do I have to travel from Japan, you know, on an overnight flight or whatever, and travel all that distance to find out that my fan club president has been effing around behind my back while I'm gone? And back in the day, you just didn't do these backyard shows. He was livid. And, you know, there was no threat to the AWA, but I think he felt a sense of betrayal. Because
did you shat your draws? Did you shat your draws?
Yeah, just a little bit. He said to me, aren't there enough rebel renegade promotions running around? For some reason, he was blown way out of proportion what we did. He said, without guys like you running around, bobbing your head up and down, you know, and taking bumps and whatever. And I said, Nick, I won't do it again. And but that was the only time in all the years that Nick was visibly pissed off at me.
One of the things that I think endeared Nick to me, or me to him, was that you talk about the kayfabe era guys, and Mick, you can attest to this. They never wanted to go outside that kayfabe, and I never pushed the buttons. But where I had an in was, Nick realized, as did most of the other wrestlers at the time, that I wasn't one of these fans that was trying to get them to tell me it was fake or I was trying to invade their space. I was there because I was interested in results and where they'd been. And Nick didn't have to break kayfabe with me because he knew that I already was aware that he was a main eventer in Georgia and that he'd had a championship in Hawaii and that he had teamed with somebody in the Pacific Northwest. He understood that and he appreciated that. And as our relationship endured, he would call upon me to ask a question about his career, things that he had forgotten. And I remember one of the classic conversations when he called me up and he said, what year was I in Buffalo? I said, you were there in 1961, but you weren't Nick Bockwinkel there. He goes, well, who the hell was I? I said, you wrestled as Roy Diamond. What? I said, yeah, you went in for four shots, four cards as Roy Diamond. He goes, oh, yeah, I know what the deal was. He says it was that damn Pedro Martinez. Martinez was the promoter. He says it was that damn Martinez. I get there. I come in. I'm supposed to be young Nicky Bockwinkel. And Martinez tells me, I don't want to bring in Nicky Bockwinkel. I want to change your name to Roy Diamond. Is that okay? And Nick says, I told him, because of his reputation of not paying boys, he says, I told Martinez, I don't care if you bill me as asshole, just as long as you pay me. And I said to Nick on the phone, I said, now, Nick, that would have been fun. In this corner at 235 pounds, asshole. We laughed about that. But he was Roy Diamond for four cards, and he was gone from Buffalo. And Nick says, well, I left because he didn't pay me. It was a great laugh.
Well, I mean, you can't make a check out to asshole, can you? I mean, can you go to a bank and cash one of those?
Well, how do you go to a bank with a check payable to Dr. X? Come on. And you're walking in with a mask pre-COVID. Come on, Chris.
So speaking about, kayfabing, tell me about the time. Did he kayfabe your six-year-old at one point?
Oh, for God's sakes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Backstory quick. Mick and I had been doing some TV announcing and hosting for a Winnipeg independent promotion, which will come up in later podcasts. We had the tapes, and this is in 1986. We had the tapes. We were looking at what we had done, Mick and I, on this show, these cards. And Nick came over to my house while we were watching the tapes, and he was going to help us critique him. We wanted his opinion, how we were doing. So Nick is completely open in the living room there. We're watching the TV, and Mick can expound on this if he chooses to. But Nick says, you know, you guys are doing good. If you can put that guy over, you've made it. You've arrived. You can put anybody over, because we were working with some real questionable talent. I mean, broomsticks would have been better. So he's really being open with us. And around the corner comes my daughter, who is 6 years old at the time. And Nick immediately silenced up and went into total kayfabe mode. And it was like, we looked at each other and thinking, he's kayfabing my six-year-old. But the classic that came out of that visit, and I'll share this, Nick had to use the restroom. So he goes out of my family room into the next door, which is the bathroom. He doesn't close the door. He stands there above the toilet with his wanger doing his thing and his hands on his hip. And I looked at Mick in the hallway and I said, ladies and gentlemen, the heavyweight champion of the world. Now, nobody can come up with a better story than he took a whiz in my house with the door open. It's great.
Oh, I don't even know where to go with that one, guys. I feel like that's a high note, right? I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
No.
Oh, man. Well, I know, was there something, Mick, I want to ask you. There's no natural transition to this, so I'm just going to say. Was there sometime that he was speaking at some cities, some college here in the cities, and you had a welt on your cheek? Does that sound familiar?
I want to say this was 1972, and Nick had established himself pretty well here in the AWA by then, and there was Augsburg College, which is near the University of Minnesota.
Yes.
Yeah, the student body had apparently voted Nick the guy that they would most like to hear come in and give a speech. Well, I got wind of the fact that Nick was going to go in and give this speech. It was wintertime, and I took the day off of work. I think I called in sick or something and went over to Augsburg to listen to Nick. And Nick's fielding questions from all the students and what have you. But the gist of his speech was talking about how to be an individual, how he had done it all on his own. And ladies and gentlemen, students, when as you go through life, you got to depend on yourself. Don't rely on anybody else for any help, blah, blah, blah. So Nick finishes the speech, and I go out in the lobby, and I see him kind of walking in circles. I said, what's the matter? He says, I don't know how the hell you get out of here. How do you get out of this place? Well, first of all, I'm thinking, this is the guy that just said, don't depend on anybody to get through life, and he can't find his way to the door. And I said that to him. I made light of it. I said, Mr. Individuality, boy, look at you. And he said, see you later, blah, blah, blah. And Nick went his way. I went my way. And there was a freshly cleaned window that I walked right into. Boom. Head first into the window. I thought it was a door. I pushed this big window. And I get this welt on my cheek, and I'm thinking to myself, please, he's not watching. I turned around and looked, and here's Nick. Ha, ha, ha. So once again, that son of a bitch got the last laugh on me. Boom. I went into that thing like a fly on a windshield.
Oh, my God.
I know I can't top that one. Mm-hmm. I think the bathroom story and that one are pretty good.
Oh, they're sweet.
But I do want to say this about a guy that was class all the way.
Oh, yeah.
I did an interview with Nick in 1996, taped it on my deck. It was sent for publication, which it was. And Nick, here's the class. We talked about a lot of things on that tape. And Nick called me when he got home that evening. And he said, you know, I've been thinking about what I said about so-and-so, and I take it out. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I shouldn't have said that. And he said, and the other thing, when I mentioned this, he says, let's leave that out because that's not professional. So he was very aware that it was important that he be, you know, come across well. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated it. And then I did remove the two things. One of the items he wanted to take out, I will point out, Mick, that it was about your co-Bockwinkel president.
Which one?
Permission slip.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And I have the original, but he wasn't favorable. Let's just leave it at that. And he didn't want it in there.
Got it.
And it made sense because as we looked at it, it shouldn't have been in there.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. All right. And I have a feeling that's just a story that, because there are some things we're going to get into, some we're not. We're going to stay out of that one, right?
Well, Nick Bockwinkel, you know, sadly, he left us a few years back now. And we're not here to bury him, and we're not here to bury any wrestler.
Yeah.
But we'll share the inside stuff when we can.
Okay. Well, let's get to some questions here, guys. Got a couple questions here from Twitter. Somebody was wondering how many of the big names lived in Minnesota back in the 70s and 80s. A friend of theirs in tech school said she'd go over to her friend's house when she was young, and every so often Ray Stevens or Nick were there visiting her friend's dad. Did guys stick around here, or did they just come in to work and then go someplace else?
Well, you have to remember, first of all, I'll take this first. This was the hub. Minneapolis was the headquarters of the AWA. And so it would be natural that a lot of the boys, when they were coming in to work the territory, they might take an apartment or rent a home or something while they were here as their base. And during their time here, Dr. X, for the 3 years he was here originally, he lived in Bloomington. But they didn't live here per se long term. But there were guys. Nick, while he was here, he lived in the Twin Cities. That's where his residence was. Mendota Heights was the last one. And of course, Jack Lanza, Larry Hennig, Stan Kowalski, Vern and Greg Gagne, Jim Brunzel. I mean, these were guys that, yeah, they were here. This was their home. But usually when the guys would come through the territory, they might just rent a place for whatever the time frame they were here.
To that point, I know that in the mid-1980s, there was an apartment complex out on, I believe, 60th and Nicollet, something like that, in Richfield. And for a time, Scott Hall, Sherry Martel, Buddy Rose, and Colonel De Beers all lived at that complex. And like George says, you know, they probably signed a year lease, maybe a two-year lease. Because this was the hub, everybody had to be here for TV anyway. So, yeah, a lot of them lived here permanently, and a lot of them, you know, for the couple of years they were in town.
So, and what Mick, was there?
Oh, Mick I remember Colonel De Beers, how he got his name. At least we think it's how he got his name.
Da Beers?
Well, we saw him down a few of the beers, with Paul Pershman.
So with, you know, kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, did these wrestlers, when they were here, guys, did they have secondary jobs? Because I know, you know, somebody thought, did Nick sell cars at one point? And, I mean, was that a thing, or was he just strictly a worker working for Vern?
There were wrestlers that were full-time wrestlers. Nick, Lanza, guys like that, the main event guys, anybody that was main event around the country, that was their full-time job. Or they were, you know, semi-wind-up guys, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there were wrestlers that supplemented their income by doing something outside. I mean, and usually it would have been the enhancement talent guys. Kenny J, he ran a sod company. That's how he got the name Sodbuster. He had a lawn service company along with one of his brothers. So, yeah, most of them in the profession that were full-time did not have any part-time job.
The only exception I would say to that is Larry Hennig, who was full-time. And Larry was in real estate for many, many years, Larry Hennig Realty. And he also, I believe, was the owner of an auction hub out in Blaine, Minnesota. So Larry had this side business. When Nick got out of wrestling, he started going to work as an insurance agent for a company called Leneve Financial. And the reason that sticks in my head is, and George will attest to this, almost every conversation that you had with Nick, once he got out of wrestling, he was pitching the insurance to you. If I had him as a guest on Saturday night at ringside, it was always, hey, you got to mention. So that was Nick's foray into another line of work. So he was set when he got out of wrestling. He didn't just go into a rocking chair and forget about it.
Well, and as you pointed out, Mick, about Larry Hennig, for example, Larry Hennig got his real estate license in 1957. And his main reason for doing this was because this was right when he was starting his wrestling career. Larry was one of the rare ones where he didn't really leave the AWA proper for any length of time. He went other places, but he lived here. He was raising his family here. And he always felt, he was wise, he always felt that if he'd get hurt in the wrestling business and unable to work, he always had that real estate to fall back on. And that's really what he did. So he had times in the business where he had to take time off to nurse injuries, and he would have the real estate as his backup.
And let's not forget Baron von Raschke. Let's not forget the Baron, who was a substitute school teacher and also for a while drove the monorail at the Minnesota Zoo. I think that's Baron's claim to fame, really, after he got out of wrestling, was driving the monorail. Plus the fact that he had a souvenir shop, and his slogan was, if you don't need it, we have it. That was the slogan for the wigwam.
Yeah, Baron, up in Lake George, Minnesota.
Yeah, we got okay. We got to keep moving along here, guys. We got like 10 minutes left. Okay. Sorry about that. I know we got kind of sidebarred there. Regarding that big belt, did Nick ever talk about how much of a pain in the neck it might have been to carry that around? Because I know wrestlers are responsible for having their own, you know, for carrying their own gear.
Well, I never heard him complain about it. It went with the championship when he was the champion. He would carry the belt with him to various towns, etc. So I never heard him complain about it. I think that just went with the territory, but maybe he said something to you, Mick. I don't
know. Nope, didn't say a word. Oh, your mic.
Just doing a lot of things here. Here we go. Got some more questions here, guys. Let's go ahead and roll through them. Here's a question for you, George, from Jerry Joy. Wants to know about his father, Warren Bockwinkel. You know, how did he start? How big of a draw was he? Because I don't think a lot of people realize when you talk about second generation wrestlers, I think people don't realize that Nick was second generation.
Nick was second generation. And in the scheme of things, Warren Bockwinkel was not the greatest wrestler in the world, but he wrestled from the 40s through the 50s. And he was a hometown boy in St. Louis. He was a good wrestler. He was respected. He was one of the boys. He did it full time. But in the scheme of things, he never held a world title or anything like that. But when you're hanging around with guys like Lou Thesz, I mean, you've got some notoriety.
The next one's for you, Mick, from Daniel Skofik. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. Was there anyone that Nick didn't like working with in the AWA?
I never heard Nick specifically say he didn't like working with somebody, which again, I think points to the class. He didn't put anybody down. The worst match I ever saw Nick wrestle was against Andre the Giant, and it wasn't Nick's fault. Andre hurt his back early in the match, and they went to a 60-minute draw. I think Nick was just very respectful, and the fact that he could make everybody look like $1 million is testament to that.
And to follow up on that, was there anybody that he really enjoyed working with?
Loved working with Greg Gagne. I know George will say that. Nick always called it a night off when he worked with Greg. His matches with Billy Robinson, I think, were the best that he had in the AWA. Whether or not he enjoyed working with Billy, they were great matches. And one of the best matches I ever saw was Nick wrestled another one-hour draw against Jim Brunzell, which was stellar. And I know he had the utmost regard for Jim.
There were actually two draws with Jim Brunzell in St. Paul, one in December of 75 and one in December of 76, a year later. Both were one-hour broadways with no outside interference from Greg or Bobby Heenan. And they were as solid a match as you've ever seen. Classics.
Yep.
Let me ask you guys this. The Stan Hansen belt debacle, what can you tell us about that?
Well, Vern was under some pressure at that point in time, trying to get a noted wrestler, a name wrestler, international flavor. Long story short, Hansen was able to come in. Both Lanza and Nick Bockwinkel, who we're talking about, basically urged Vern, don't put it on Stan. They had nothing against Stan personally. It was just Stan's personality and his reputation of sort of going into a territory and not wanting to do what promoters wanted him to do. And Vern didn't listen. We get into, this is a complicated story, but Stan was making money in Japan with Baba, Giant Baba, and he was doing really well over there. So Vern explained to him that if I put the title on you, you're going to have to defend the title here too. And when I need you. Well, eventually that went sour because Stan was spending more time in Japan. He felt his allegiance was to Baba. Vern said, I've had enough. I'm going to take the title off of you. Nick's going to win it. Stan disagreed because he was going to Japan and he was going to be billed as champion over there. And he walked out of the auditorium in Denver on the night he was supposed to wrestle Nick. And Vern just basically on a spur of the moment, having to make a boss's decision, put the title on Nick by default. And of course that sets wrong with a lot of people. They think there should have been a tournament and whatever, but I never faulted Vern for it. And the only thing I've ever said about this is I've always said that Stan, when he was working for Vern, Vern was his boss. When he was working for Baba, Baba was his boss. And what he did with Vern was he crossed his boss and said, I'm not going to do what you asked me to do. So Stan, in my opinion, was wrong. But we'll leave it at that because we'll talk about that in more detail later on.
And yes, Stan Hansen did run over the AWA championship belt with his truck and mail the title back to Vern Gagne. And I asked Stan about that. He says, yeah, I accidentally ran over the belt about 10, 15 times.
Hey, from Eric Martin here for you, Mick. What do you think about his babyface run towards the end of his era? Was it good for him to be a babyface at the end?
Absolutely. You know, if you look at AWA history, almost every heel that was here for any length of time finished their career as a babyface. Baron Von Raschke, The Crusher, Larry Hennig, Mad Dog Vachon, they all finished as a babyface. Nick, I think, had that built-in respect from the fans anyway. They wanted to cheer him. They couldn't bring themselves to do it. But the last couple of years of his career, definitely the right decision, and he was over huge as a babyface.
All right. And one last question for you, George. I know that we saw the Million Dollar Man in WWF, Ted DiBiase. Was there any speculation or truth to the rumor that maybe Nick might have been groomed for that? And maybe if he wasn't as far along, I think it was like, you know, over 50, would that have been a gimmick for him in the WWF?
Well, I've heard those stories that McMahon had considered him or maybe approached Nick. The only thing I ever remember Nick saying was, is that at that point in his career, he was still loyal to the AWA to a fault. And he said, you know, I was in my 50s and I just didn't think it was the right move at the right time. I think a little bit of it is that Nick was along with some of the others where he didn't think that McMahon was going to succeed as he did in that invasion. But yeah, he was considered and he would have been great. I mean, I think the fans would have bought it. I mean, how many wrestlers have we seen repackaged over the years? And if he'd have had Heenan with him, if that would have worked out, yeah, I think it could have. But in hindsight, which I always like to look back to, because it's always 2020, I think we can all agree that DiBiase was the best choice for that role. And Nick wouldn't have been able to probably have it for as long as DiBiase was able to do it.
All right, and last question here, guys, before we get to the trivia. This one, Mick, kind of tell us about the last time that you saw Nick.
Ooh. Last time I saw Nick was in April of 2015 at Cauliflower Alley, and I knew Nick was not doing very well. Nick, of course, was succumbing to Alzheimer's for a while, and I didn't know if he was going to be at this reunion in 2015. So I sent a message to his wife and I said, is Nick going to be there? She said, yes, he is, but he's only going to be there for a very short time. That's my favorite picture, by the way. He's only going to be there for a short time because I don't want people saying, oh, I remember Nick when, and isn't it sad what's happened to Nick and so on and so forth. Long story short, I didn't know even if Nick was going to recognize me when he got to the building, to the hotel. Well, not only did he recognize me, but he was using a walker at the time, and he aimed it in my direction and came at me full speed ahead. So I knew that everything was okay there as he crashed into my shins. The night that this picture was taken, they had announced that Nick and his wife, Darlene, were no longer going to be attending Cauliflower Alley Club conventions. They could kind of see the handwriting on the wall. And so they gave Nick a standing ovation. And a little bit later on, I approached him and I said, Bockwinkel, can you put me over one more picture, just one last picture? And he looked at me and he said, absolutely not. Well, that's when I kneeled down next to him and that picture was taken of the two of us laughing together. And I said to him at the time, I figured this is it. I got to say something. I said, Bockwinkel, I love you. I said, I would not have anything that I have in the wrestling business as far as announcing is concerned if it wasn't for you, Nick. And Nick got teared up and he said, is that so? And Nick started crying and I started crying. And that was it. That was the last time I saw Nick, really last time I had any contact with him. And boy, little did I know that 6 months later, he would not be with us anymore. So bittersweet, but I'm glad I got that picture.
All right. Before we get to, we got like 2 minutes here, guys. We got to wrap it up here quick. We do have a trivia question that we want to go ahead and let you guys know. But last week's trivia question, last week's winner, Jay Larson from Minneapolis, Joe LeDuc was the correct answer to the trivia question. What was the question last week, Mick? And in about 90 seconds, let's get this week's out so we can get it going.
Absolutely. The question was, which wrestler pulled an MTC bus as part of a test of strength? It was Joe LeDuc. This week's trivia question is a two-parter and it relates to Nick Bockwinkel. And they're both referee questions. It's a two-parter. Who was the referee the night that Nick won the championship from Vern Gagne in 1975? And part two, in the 1980s, someone who was related to Nick Bockwinkel was refereeing for the AWA. And I want to know who that was as well. So a two-part question.
And people have until January 20th to email right there to mickarch@gmail.com. Again, guys, it's time to go home. We're going to run out of TV time here. And unfortunately, we have to have a decision. We got to have a pinfall by the 60-minute. We can't go 60-minute Broadway. So that being said, I want to thank everybody again for the fantastic response. Catch us on all your podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google, Amazon, just search AWA Unleashed. And also, if you've got a question or a comment, let us know on Twitter at that, or you can tell Slick Mick Old School Wrestling or George Shire's Time Machine. Guys, it's been great. I know we could have gone a lot longer. Unfortunately, we have a one-hour time limit, so it's been great. And hopefully people will enjoy this one just as much as they enjoyed the first two.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Nick. God bless you.